today. A conversation with Reni Edo-Lodge.
Right, so you've, in the middle of all this, you've been moving house. How long has that been going on?
About a week. All of this stuff was going on around the time of, like, moving and getting stuff out of storage and setting up, and yeah, it's been a bit mad.
The past month has been one of huge upheavals for Reni Edo-Lodge, both on a personal and very public level. The death of George Floyd in the US has ignited conversations about race, racism, and white privilege. The types of conversations that many black people are tired of having, but that many white people have frankly been able to ignore. On social media, people have been sharing reading lists, offering suggestions of books to help others understand how structural racism infects our society. The book that comes up time and again is Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, which Reni wrote in 2017. The resurgence of interest in it has made her the first black British author to top the UK bestseller chart.
You know, it's exciting, and like, I'm hoping the Guinness World Records is going to send me a plaque, but it's still kind of mad, isn't it? Like, especially when you think of all the black British authors, you know, who I'm sure you've read and I've read, and you're like, really?
Reni has conflicting feelings about her book's recent success and how some readers look to her as a guide.
I guess what I'm trying to do with the book is tell people in general, take responsibility for racism. And part of taking responsibility for anything in your life is using your own brain, not just being like, okay, well, Reni said I should do this, so I'm going to do this. I actually think that kind of like weird reverence of me and my work and looking to me for leadership. You know, I'm just a normal person, okay, who wrote a book. I'm not really looking to lead anyone.
She now gives very few interviews, but she agreed to speak to Observer reporter Nisheen Iqbal and let her record their conversation for us to talk about today.
Maybe I would have written under a pseudonym for my own sanity. Yeah, sometimes I think about it because I really, really don't like being a public figure. And it's, again, I think it's just naivety on my part at the beginning of this journey that I didn't anticipate that it would turn me into a public figure.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, Reni Edo-Lodge and why talking about race has gone viral. Nisheen, over the past few weeks, the death of George Floyd in America has sparked protests that have spread across the world. And it's also set off this huge conversation on social media about race and racism. How have you felt watching this unfold?
So it's been a month since George Floyd died, and it's just been intense. I feel like the needle has flickered. The mainstream understanding of racism is getting more sophisticated. People are beginning to understand that racism is a system rather than just a slur. It's prejudice plus power. And it feels like there is change in the air. But then people like Reni, and I guess myself to some extent, you know, who've been thinking and talking and living and studying and reading about race for as long as you can remember, you're also kind of wary. You're just so desperate for it not to, for the moment, not to dissipate.
It's felt like a lot of people, particularly white people, and companies are showing support for the Black Lives Matter movement in a way that they wouldn't have done before.
This is interesting because you have empty, shallow rhetoric, and then you have some genuine reflection and pragmatic attempts to do better. But I've written about this concept of woke washing before, which basically is brands using a message of social justice to ultimately advance their profits. And I know that people may think, oh, that's a really horribly cynical thing to say, like, you know, Nike, Levi's, Pepsi, they're making big commitments and it's for the public good, which, yes, to a degree it is. But, you know, those big companies also have very sophisticated marketing departments. And you've had Uncle Ben's Rice having their packaging updated because, I guess, presumably to acknowledge that the stereotype of black servitude that they were born in is no longer appropriate. And, you know, you've got fashion houses and beauty companies. I mean, even my gym sent me an email saying that they were acknowledging the cultural appropriation of their hip-hop dance class.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And in a way, is it too cynical to say it's sort of the same for people as well? I mean, there's willingness to try and learn and understand this time round that we haven't seen before.
I don't think it is too cynical to say. I mean, I'm finding that people I know, friends who I've never spoken to about racism, really are starting to discuss it.
I've recently been explaining race being akin to having like an immortal wasp buzzing about in your brain, in the sense that sometimes it's dormant, you can forget about it, and often it's just buzzing in the periphery. And then sometimes in moments like now, it's front and center. It's really annoying. And I often wish that I didn't, you know, see the world through this sort of obscured lens, and that, you know, race could be the fascinating, abstract dinner party construct rather than a lived reality. And I do, and I'm often aware that if I feel like that as, you know, as a British Pakistani Muslim woman who's highly privileged and educated, working as a journalist at, you know, an influential liberal newspaper, then how does, you know, someone who is more disenfranchised, how does a black person feel?
What you're saying is this needs to go much further than white people having frank conversations. This should be a moment of reckoning for the whole of society. A big part of this is about people educating themselves. And this has been talked about a lot on social media with people sharing reading lists. And the book that comes up time and again is Rennie's book, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, which actually came out 3 years ago. Can you tell me a bit about how she came to write it?
She'd been an activist in feminist and anti-racism circles, and she hit a point where she was just fed up. She hit a point and she was fed up of having to talk about racism to people who already think they're there by dint of thinking that they're already on the left or that they're liberal. People who weren't understanding that just because they weren't using the N-word did not mean that they weren't racist. So she wrote a blog post. And so the book came about from that.
Okay, so it started as a blog post. How did she expand that into a book?
So Rennie's book is something of a misnomer, because obviously in the title she says she's no longer talking to white people about race. But of course, to some extent, this is what she's been doing and what she'll carry on doing, I guess, for much of her career. In the actual book, she explains why she's fed up of justifying her existence, her history, the direct effects of racism to white people who refuse to actually listen. And then she sweeps readers through Britain's history of the slave trade. She explains white privilege. She talks about intersectionality. And, you know, she brings up big themes that you all have known from sort of academic tomes and critical race theory, and does them in a really chatty, accessible way, which I think is the key to the success of this book.
There's a chapter in the book about white privilege, a term that's being discussed a lot at the moment. How does she define it?
Well, to quote her directly, she says, white privilege is the fact that if you're white, your race will almost certainly positively impact your life's trajectory in some way, and you probably won't even notice it. She introduces this concept for people to recognise that when she's talking about racism, that it's not just actively being hateful to someone of a different skin colour. It's sort of deeper and more layered and more insidious than that. And it works at a institutional level. The institutions that govern us, it's the way society's structured, which is to, in a Western context at least, it's designed to benefit whiteness at every level.
Being involved in feminist work and being involved in anti-racist work, one thing that you notice very quickly is that we have racism but no racists, you know? We also have, you know, one in four women saying they've been raped or sexually assaulted in their life, but no rapists, no self-confessed rapists, no self-confessed racists. You know, we see the structural impact on how these things affect marginalized people, but we see literally nobody admitting to participating in the marginalization.
And Rennie focuses on structural racism in the UK, which I think many people here just don't recognise. I think often we look at what happens in the US with this sense of superiority, believing that kind of racism just doesn't happen in this country.
Yeah, there's assumption over here that the problems in the US are sort of distant and they are uniquely American problems, and that we don't have the same relationship to race, and, you know, things are much better here. And that is such a denial of the situation. I mean, yes, we don't have armed police with guns, and we don't have guns generally in this country. But, you know, what we do have is a very long and complex history with Commonwealth and with empire.
We live in a country that attempts to try and pride itself on fair play, but is really resistant to any attempt at trying to analyse what fair play actually looks like. It's a twee passive-aggressive faux politeness that is really invested in the proper way to do things.
And what she means when she talks about racism in this country is she's not just talking about the far right. So the conversation isn't about them, really, in this context.
Martin Luther King Jr. called it, you know, a negative piece, you know, just sweep it under the carpet.
And what Rennie is trying to do is the opposite of that. Instead of sweeping this issue under the carpet, she's trying to expose it.
I think genuinely, you know, she hoped and felt that this would mean that the panel show sort of discussions about racism might be obliterated to some degree. I think she might have thought, this, do you know what, this is the answer, I've done it, they'll finally understand.
Sometimes I think it was naivety that led me to do this work, and I went into it earnestly, really thinking that I could try and make some change in the world.
But you did, though.
I did make change in the world. And the fact that, like, I hear from readers on a regular basis who tell me how the book has either affirmed them and made them felt that they weren't going loopy, or has completely, like, fundamentally changed their perspective, that's great. Because I think back to, like, 24-year-old me, which is how old I was when I wrote that blog post, and I think what felt very specific and particular to a situation in my life at the time, my specific situation ended up being incredibly universal.
The book did really well at the time, and I thought it was the way she'd written it. You know, the language she used felt really accessible.
When I spoke about this with Rennie, she had a lot to say about that.
That was important to me when I had the opportunity to write a book. And, you know, like, I suppose to publish this book with a publisher that had the kind of, like, clout and distribution to make sure that it was available in a bookshop in a small town or village.
And yeah, so she went with Bloomsbury, which, you know, was independent, but also had that big Harry Potter money to get her book out into all the bookshops, you know, the random small ones in small villages.
I didn't want it to be published in such a way where only, like, the London literati would read it, and high-minded, you know, people who went to Oxbridge read it and went, yes, and then wrote about it in literary reviews.
Rennie was only in her late 20s when the book was first published, which is much younger than many first-time authors. And because it did so well, she got a lot of attention, went on a big publicity tour. What did she say to you about what that experience was like?
Her publicity tour, I guess, part of the publicity was is to appear on shows and say yes to the media press and TV and stuff. And what she quickly found was that she didn't want to be engaging in a shouting match on Woman's Hour or any of the political programmes on the telly.
When I look around at Britain and the British commentariat, and I realise that so many people are just playing characters, and I feel like the way I was received by the British media landscape was, okay, well, can you play a character for us now, you know? I received calls from television producers who literally referred to casting. And I'm like, well, I'm not an actress, so I don't know why you're asking me to participate in the conversation in this way.
Any story that came into the news cycle about Black people or Black lives, that's when, you know, the attention will come and they want her to be on and talk about these things.
Rennie Edo-Lodge is a writer involved with the organisation Black Feminists.
She's now written a book by the same title. But will the title put people off?
Do you feel as though you're having an impact? Are you changing anything?
Well, I'm the wrong person to ask, because obviously I'm in the eye of the storm here.
Ultimately, she says, she comes from a very evidence-based background and the conversation in Britain isn't necessarily geared towards that. It's more about, well, let's have a furious debate and listen to all sides. And for some of us, when you feel something is fundamentally right, which is anti-racism, we recognise that there is no all sides to this.
I mean, Stuart Hall wrote about this in the 80s. Like, it's a fundamental and pervasive question in the British media. And, like, I can't speak for white people because I'm not one of them. But maybe some of them are starting to recognise how disturbing it is.
Rennie is now the first Black British person to top the UK bestseller chart. But is this a celebratory moment for her? I imagine in some ways this might feel bittersweet.
This moment, you know, her book sales have come about because people, as she says in her words, have watched a man dying.
It's a source of conflict for me to know that suddenly a whole bunch of people have been brought to my work through watching someone die on camera. That's very disturbing. I tried hard to avoid that video, but I saw it on BBC Breakfast. And I just think I wouldn't see a video of a white person being murdered on BBC Breakfast when I'm eating my granola. Part of me thinks, you know, the recording and documenting of these tragedies is important because it is evidence for something that Black people have been saying anecdotally for a long time. But another part of me, I do think that it adds to an existing dehumanization, you know. It felt like a link between that and the star of my work rising again. I couldn't uncouple it. I couldn't unlink it.
I couldn't believe it when I found out that the only other Black author to have topped the UK book charts is Michelle Obama. What does that tell us about the publishing industry?
Gosh, that's really interesting, isn't it? What it tells us is that we're in a really quite oppressively awful space. And B, then look at the publishing industry, which at the moment is being forced to reckon with what it's for and who it's for. I know that there's a spreadsheet going around in which people in publishing are disclosing their salaries, their job titles, their ethnicity to show the disparities. And in the same way that the hashtag What Publishing Paid Me became a huge thing online, in which authors disclosed what their advances were, just so it's really abundantly clear that this problem of how we value white writers versus how we value Black writers is completely different, and it's racist, essentially.
The author Marlon James, who won the Booker Prize a few years ago, he basically said that he's tired of being told by publishers that the only people who buy books are like middle-aged, not white women, and so the content of the book has got to appeal to them. There's a very like weird and flawed perception in publishing about who the books are being published for and who's going to read them and why. And I'm sure that's informed by who goes to literary festivals. You know, I've been to dozens of literary festivals since the book was published. And every time I come off the stage, I'm told by people who are involved in organising the event, "Renny, you brought such a diverse crowd, you know, to your event. It's not our usual crowd."
After this, more books to read on anti-racism and how to turn words into action. But first, the British Podcast Awards are being held on July the 11th, and Today in Focus has been nominated in 3 categories, but we could win in 1 more with your help. If you haven't yet voted for us to win the Listener's Choice Award, please go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and type Today in Focus into the search bar. The whole team would be very, very grateful. Thank you. Nisheen, there'll be people listening who I'm sure will go out and buy Renny's book if they haven't already. What are the lessons they can take from it?
The fundamental lessons are to acknowledge their own whiteness, to acknowledge how that culture and history has affected people of colour to this day. And, you know, the fact that it's not enough to feel that you're not racist or discriminatory in any way. So Renny says that, you know, guilt isn't a useful emotion, which I would entirely agree. So it's not enough for white people to sort of sit there feeling guilty. They have to go out and take action.
I often get this question. I think sometimes at events as well, you know, well, how do you feel about white readers doing this? How do you feel about white readers doing that? It's out of my hands.
Yeah.
I didn't want people to come read the book feeling disempowered. I hope that it would, like, engender critical thinking. And sometimes the questions that I get that, you know, imply that I'm going to give people leadership almost comes across as people just basically giving up their power to me.
Yeah.
And I think that's very troubling, you know.
It's different for each person, right? It's recognising the influence you have and how you use it. If you see someone being racist to someone on public transport, challenge the racist. It's not enough to afterwards ask the victim, "Are you okay?" I mean, that's nice. And if, say, for instance, you work in an organisation which has very few Black people working there, then ask why and do more to try and influence recruitment. You also reminded me, I had a colleague ask me quite earnestly once, "Well, you know, how do I go out and make Black friends? You can't Tinder them." And my answer to that was, you know, at the time, was to laugh. What you do say, or what you should reflect on, is that examine the circles that you move in, you know, the people you met at uni, at work, at parties, and think about why there is such a deficit of Black people in those privileged, comfortable spaces, because it's not as if they're not there and it's not as if they don't want to be there, but you have to make room for them.
Do you worry that for some people, for some white people, the act of buying a book makes them feel like they've done the work But actually buying books can just become an act of virtue signalling rather than leading to a personal examination of somebody's own racism.
I mean, the concept of virtue signalling is quite harmful because, you know, people want to feel good about doing things, and I don't want to criticise them for that. However, as you say, and as is true, yeah, for some people the journey starts and ends with buying this book, being known to have read this book, and you know this because they posted it on social media, and this conversation isn't relevant just for white people, it's for all other communities in which anti-blackness is pervasive and endemic. And, you know, there are important conversations all of us can have with people that we know.
It's not just in the UK that anti-racism books are topping bestseller lists. I mean, in the US, Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, has been number one over the past few weeks. But what would you recommend people read to further their understanding of these issues?
Personally, I veer to fiction because I feel those are the stories that really resonate. And so if you're reading, you know, in authors like Helen Oyeyemi, Ayobami Adebayo, Yar Gyasi, Tayari Jones, just by dint of reading about other lives and other worlds, I think has sometimes, well, for me, has a bigger impact. And, you know, then you, when I think about the books that, you know, led to my own consciousness around this, it was autobiographies of Malcolm X, Angela Davis, Muhammad Ali, Maya Angelou, Margot Jefferson, Frederick Douglass. Like, there's a wealth of books out there, and I don't think it should be incumbent on a reader to feel that they have to start with a manual. Start with the stories, and, you know, and then go on to Akala and David Olusoga and Cornel West and all the rest of it.
You asked Renée if she feels optimistic about this as a moment of real change. Does she?
She said, ask her in 5 years' time.
You may have been able to tell throughout the course of this conversation that I do lean towards the cynical, but I do feel optimistic that the atmosphere has shifted, and I feel dismayed at the circumstances that led to that, you know. And I feel interested about the fact that things have moved to such an extent where everyone's saying Black Lives Matter now.
She said, as someone like her who's been embedded in this work for so long, she wants to feel optimistic. She doesn't quite, but then relented and said, well, do you know what? I saw Angela Davis, the iconic Angela Davis, on TV recently, and she said she's never seen anything this in her life before.
We are finally witnessing the consequences of decades and centuries of attempting to expel racism from our societies.
And if Angela Davis is optimistic, Renée says she's optimistic, and then same for me. If both of those guys are optimistic, I will be too.
Nisheen, thank you very much for speaking to me.
No worries, thank you.
You can read Nisheen's interview with Renée at theguardian.com, where I'm also excited to say you can listen to a new Guardian podcast, which is all about conversations. Innermost is presented by Leah Green and lets you in on the lives of strangers around the world. Listen to it at the website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for today. Thank you to Nisheen Iqbal and Renée Edo-Lodge. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.